Thank you very much for the very generous introduction. In fact, I was saying this to one of my friends the other week, is that me being an expert on Iraq is such a weird position for me. I mean, through my life in Iraq, I was just one boring architect who designs houses. And so, like, just to give an analogy of how I turned into an expert, I was telling my friend, is like, imagine you going to this other planet, just like finding yourself in this other planet, and then being called an Earth expert. And then all of these people on this other planet are asking you questions about Earth, and then you're telling them about details. And then there are these discussions about, is water on Earth, is it yellow or red? And you're trying to convince them that it's neither yellow nor red. So this is what I'm trying to convince the U.S. Congress, that the water in Iraq is not yellow and it's not red. Most of my work with the AFSC is based on trying to educate Congress members on issues that, concerns the Iraq situation, and what are the realities in Iraq concerning violence, what are the roots of the conflict, and how do Iraqis in general view the conflict. Now, these information are not secret information. I read them every day in the Iraqi 4 or 5 newspapers online, and through the 6 Iraqi TV stations that I watch online as well, and through my contact with the Iraqi Council of Representatives, which is the Iraqi parliament. The Iraqi government has 2 major entities: the parliament, that was elected by millions of Iraqis, and the cabinet, that was selected with a very heavy intervention by the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. The parliament, that you can see its map, the map that I produced some 9 months ago, explaining how the parliament looks like. The parliament is actually more representative of the Iraqi public than the cabinet, due to the fact that it was elected directly, and due to the fact that the U.S. Embassy prevented anyone who is not pro-occupation from being a part of the Iraqi cabinet. So what we usually hear on TVs or from Iraqi officials, or when U.S. Congress members go to Iraq and meet with the Council of Ministers and the Prime Minister and his assistants, we hear the voice of the Council of Ministers that is not really representative of what the Iraqi parliament is saying. It's not really representative of what the Iraqi public is saying. So as the diagram shows, what started in Iraq with the parliament as sectarian-based coalitions, which are the ones that you can see in circles. The circles are the sectarian-based coalitions. Iraqis first, when the elections happened, it was a continuation of the sectarian-based system that was created by Paul Bremer. Paul Bremer created the Governing Council, which was the first incident, the first precedent in Iraq's contemporary history, where Iraqis get chosen to rule the country based on their sectarian or ethnic background. So laws, the regulations of the elections were created to continue this imposed notion of Iraqis being represented based on their sectarian belonging. But what happened is that some few months after the elections, the political split that is, you can see the vertical line in the middle. This political split happened in a clear way in the Iraqi parliament, and the political split made it clear that the Iraqi-Iraqi conflict is not a conflict between Sunnis and Shia. It's a conflict between Sunnis and Shia who are nationalists against other Sunnis and Shia who are separatists. In fact, the bigger picture, it's a conflict between those who are Sunnis or Shia or Kurds or secular or Turkmen or Christian or Yazidis who are nationalists and those who are the same, Sunnis or Shia or Turks or Kurds or Christian or seculars who are separatists. What do these two groups stand for? The nationalists want to have one united country with one central government, while separatists want to have three different sectarian and ethnic-based regions. Let me open a bracket just to explain what does this mean. There is an unannounced independent state in the north of Iraq. It's called Kurdistan. Kurdistan is an independent state that has its own army. The Iraqi army is not allowed to reach that border. It has its own parliament and government and president. It has its own flag. If someone puts the Iraqi flag on in Kurdistan, they will be put in jail. Because you can't put the Iraqi flag in Kurdistan. It has its own embassies and visas. When my dad visited Erbil last month, he had to go to the Kurdish consulate. Which is, in reality, it's an embassy because it's completely separate from the Iraqi embassy, right? So this prototype, this type of separation that is called soft separation because it's not announced, in opposed to hard separation where people, you know, announce themselves as an independent state, this type of separation one is the prototype that other Sunnis and Shias want to repeat it and create a Sunnistan and a Shiastan. Now, these Sunnis and Shia who want to create a Sunnistan and a Shiastan are a minority according to polls and are a minority according to the number of seats in the Iraqi parliament. According to polls, around 3/4 of the Iraqi population are for keeping their country united with one central government. According to the parliament, more than 55% of the Iraqi parliamentarians are for keeping their country united with one central government. Close the bracket. There's a long bracket. The second point of conflict between nationalists and separatists is the issue of natural resources. Natural resources as in gas and oil. Nationalists want gas and oil to be owned by the central government and by the Iraqi people, and that the contract decision and contracting process must happen, through Baghdad and Baghdad only. Separatists, on the other hand, Sunni and Shia separatists, want to decentralize the contracting process in a way that gives someone in Ramadi the right to sign his or her own gas contracts, someone in the north, in Kurdistan, to sign their own oil and gas contracts, someone in Basra to sign, opening the doors for splitting Iraq into the three sectarian-based nations. The third maybe more important issue of conflict between the two parties or the two sides of the political spectrum is the foreign intervention, the U.S. Military intervention and the Iranian and Saudi and Al-Qaeda and many other foreign interventions. Nationalists are against anyone, whether this one was American or Canadian or Iranian or Al-Qaeda or Buddhist from Tibet, they don't care. They're against anyone to come occupy their country and interfere in their domestic issues. Separatists, on the other hand, are for a long-term U.S. presence. I'll speak more about why. And they are for a stronger intervention relationship between them and other countries that are supporting these separatist parties in Iraq. Now, why would separatists fight demand that the U.S. Occupation should stay there in the long run, one may ask? Let me give you an example to see how these dynamics work. Last month, the Iraqi army attacked the city of Diwaniya, which is a northern city. And the Iraqi police was defending the city from the attack. Why? Because the Iraqi army is loyal to a Shia separatist group. The Iraqi police is loyal to a Shia nationalist group. So the Iraqi police that was attacking the city represents a minority of Shia. The Iraqi army, the Iraqi police that was protecting the city represents a majority of nationalist Shia. What the U.S. did, as usual, is that it took parts in this conflict. The U.S. is not a peacekeeping force. The U.S. is not a force that is shielding Iraqis from their neighbors and creating a space for reconstruction. The U.S. is taking the side, propping up the side of a minority of Iraqis, the separatists, to destroy the majority who are nationalists. So what the U.S. did is that the U.S. airplanes dropped leaflets on the Diwaniya saying, "Police stay home." Police, of course, didn't stay home. So they bombed their center and they killed a number of police members of the city and supported the army to take over the city. This is a good example why separatists, who represent a minority of Iraqis, will want the U.S. to stay. Why would any sane political leader who knows that he represents a quarter of a population and he's getting the superpower of the world to spend $720 million a day on military operations supporting him? Why would they negotiate with the other side? They don't have to, right? They would be crazy if they did, in fact. Why would they? And that's why this dynamic where the U.S. Authorities in Iraq supports the minority against the majority is the dynamic that is creating this very clear reaction from the Iraqi public. 80%, according to polls, 80% of the Iraqi public think that the U.S. presence in Iraq is making things worse. And the same portion, more than three-fourths of Iraqis, 80%, think that once the U.S. pulls out, the situation will become better. And a higher number of Iraqis want the U.S. to completely withdraw from their country, completely withdraw, without leaving any permanent bases. Now, when we listen to what the Iraqis are saying in general and what the Iraqi political parties are saying, what the Iraqi representatives of the majority are saying, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or seculars, what they are saying is that we need a complete withdrawal from our country that leaves no permanent bases, no mercenaries, and no troops. They are not splitting hairs regarding when this should withdrawal start, like what the Congress is doing. Start after 2 weeks or after 3 months? They're not splitting hairs about how long this withdrawal should be, 1 year or 18 months or 2 years. But they care very much about that this withdrawal will be complete, that the last U.S. soldier or mercenary will leave Iraq. And this is the thing that is not being discussed in the U.S. because both Democrats and Republicans are speaking about levels of troops, speaking about exceptions for keeping troops on the long run, speaking about long permanent bases presence there. We don't find the demands of the public, the majority of the Iraqi public, reaching to the United States. What does this mean? It means that the U.S. Proposals for dealing with the Iraqi situation will not change things on the ground. Why? Because for the Iraqis, for the majority of Iraqis, whether they were in the parliament or in the public, whether they were in the parliament or in the public, who are usually linked directly or indirectly to the 5,000 military attacks against U.S. troops a month, right? For this majority of Iraqis, they don't care whether there is an occupation or a one-quarter occupation or one-half occupation. They don't want any occupation in their country. And the U.S. is not dealing with this as a political fact, that unless there is an announcement that there will be a complete withdrawal for all troops and mercenaries and that no permanent bases will be left in Iraq. Nothing will change in Iraq. The political situation will stay the same. The military situation will stay the same. Let me show you this video, because there isn't enough knowledge about what mercenaries are doing in Iraq. There are 140,000 private contractors in Iraq, in addition to the 160,000 U.S. troops. 140,000 private contractors. Most of them are security private contractors, as in people with guns. Let me show you this video. It shows what a part of these, one of these contractor companies posted online. They posted online. I feel sleepy when the lights go on off. What they posted online is a video of mercenaries going around the streets of Iraq, killing civilians for fun. So they actually didn't just do it. They filmed it, they put music, and they think it's funny. Now, these people are not terrorists, right? These people are our tax money-funded terrorists. Blackwater alone, it's one of the companies that is in Iraq. It gets paid $1 billion a year. Compared to how much is the entire payments that went to humanitarian aid?
$250 million a year.
So, let's see this. The scene, of course, is from the back seat of a car that mercenaries are using. And they are shooting randomly against civilian cars that are causing no threat. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. Train, train. The car in orange and white is a taxi. It's a civilian's taxi. And the car that is coming is just some random person. They shoot him and kill him. So the car hits the other one. And people in the other car run away. They think this is funny. This is around the neighborhood that I actually used to live in Baghdad. I think they are throwing grenades in the street. The fence on the left, I think, is the fence of the airport road. I'm not pretty sure, but I think it's around the neighborhood. So I can't stop thinking that people who are being killed in these pictures might be me or my brother or something. They're just someone driving, work, going to the grocery shop or something. I mean, just to put things in context, these are the ones who filmed it and posted it online themselves, you know? No one caught them red-handed. They filmed that and put it online because, not because they were confessing, because they thought it's funny. They thought it's funny to go around. Just to put things in context, 140,000 mercenaries in Iraq, in a country that the population is one-tenth of the U.S. population, means 1.5 million mercenaries going around U.S. streets, shooting civilians with no any control of law. There is no police to stop them. even if police stop them, the U.S. judicial system doesn't have any control over them. One of the Blackwater mercenaries was drunk, and he killed the bodyguard of the prime minister, the vice prime minister. So he shot the bodyguard of the vice prime minister and killed him. I mean, just see how like obvious it is. It's inside the green zone, in front of everyone. So the Iraqi government demanded that he should be sent to trial. They took him to the U.S. the next day. The U.S. embassy took him to the U.S. He's here somewhere, going and walking some neighborhood. Proud of himself, I'm sure. So when 80% of the Iraqi public say that the U.S. presence in Iraq is making things worse, they're not theorizing about it. They actually know what they're talking about. They've paid that from their own blood, from their own family's blood, from their own safety and security. When 80% of the Iraqi public realize and say that things will become better after the U.S. leaves, they don't mean that things will become, you know, Iraq will turn into heaven in like overnight or something. In fact, what they are saying, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or secular who are against the war, they are saying that there is a very long process that may take up to decades to rebuild Iraq and stabilize Iraq and rebuild the Iraqi state and have Iraqi reconciliation. But we can't do anything about this. We can't start the first step before a complete U.S. withdrawal from there. So have no, you know, confusion about it. It's not like the U.S. will withdraw and we should just feel good about ourselves and, you know, drop the issue of Iraq. A U.S. withdrawal should happen in context that the moral and legal obligation that we have as U.S. taxpayers and that the U.S. government has as an occupation government, this moral obligation is still there. But it cannot be pursued. It cannot be implemented through military means. So let me give you an example. Iraq occupied Kuwait in 1990. And Iraq is still paying compensation because of that illegal occupation until this day. 5% of Iraq's oil revenue goes to Kuwait as compensation. Are the Iraqi mercenaries and troops going around Kuwait city shooting civilians? No. Is the Iraqi government telling the Kuwaitis how to spend their compensation? No, it's none of their business. But did the Iraqis stop paying compensation? No, as well. Because it's the Kuwaitis' right to get compensation for the destruction that happened there. So there are precedents and there are mechanisms within the international law and international organizations to pursue the United States' commitment and obligation to help Iraqis rebuild Iraq and fix the crimes that happened there without having military presence there. Because the military presence is preventing Iraqis from starting the first step towards reconciliation and reconstruction. Now, how can we link all of this to other issues? For let's say, for example, oil, right? Or refugees, or reconstruction, or all of these things, without having understanding of the real roots of the conflict in Iraq, we will not be reaching to the correct analysis or the correct solutions for the conflict. Without understanding that it's a political-based conflict, not a sectarian-based conflict, we wouldn't understand how to deal with it. If we wanted to buy the myth that was created by the Bush administration, that it's a Sunni-Shia civil war that has been going on for 1,400 years, we should stay there to protect those crazy Muslims from each other, right? This is the way that it's understood. One of the facts that I always feel that it surprises U.S. audience is when I say that as someone who's half Sunni and half Shia, who was born in Iraq and lived most of my life there, I've never heard of this Sunni Shia thing. And like when they said the Ba'ath regime was a Sunni regime, I really like didn't buy it at all. But I didn't find like a solid way to prove it until I discovered that the deck of cards, you know, the 55 deck of cards that have the pictures of Saddam and his sons, and which was actually representative of the top leaders in the Ba'ath Party, the 55 top leaders in the Ba'ath Party. 36 of them were Shia. So if it was really a Sunni Ba'ath regime, how come 36 of them were Shia? Of course, this is not because Ba'athists were nice to Shia or Kurds or Christians or whomever. It was a political dictatorship that didn't recognize any of these sectarian divisions. It destroyed anyone who was against the president and supported anyone who is for the president. Sounds familiar now after living in the US. So without understanding that these dynamics of Sunni-Shia things, like the fights that are imposed on Iraqis, were created and imposed within the last few years, and that there are Sunni-Shia tensions. It's very easy to create hatred. The thing that I say, we need three irresponsible racist white boys to throw nooses over the tree in Jannah and start tension all around the country. Imagine if this wasn't three nooses, imagine if these were three bombed cars that are being put between black and white neighborhood, between Protestant and Catholic, between Christian and Jewish, for 4 years. Of course people will have sectarian tension. But the point is not about denying or accepting the sectarian tension. It's about understanding that this sectarian tension doesn't have a sectarian solution. It has a political solution. When the Sunnis and Shia, who are separatists, came to the country and wanted to split the country into Sunnistan and Shiastan, one major obstacle that faced them was the 2 million Sunnis in Shiastan and the 2 million Shia in Sunnistan, right? So when Shia separatists attack Sunnis or Shia, when Sunni separatists attack Sunnis or Shia, are they attacking them because they are Sunnis or Shia? Can we bring them to the table and let them speak about religions and God and they will stop attacks? Of course not, because it doesn't have a sectarian solution. It has a political solution. And this political solution will never happen if the US is there, because the US is preventing an Iraqi political solution. So without understanding this, we will fall in the myth of we can't withdraw because the sky will fall and the Sunnis and Shiites will kill each other, right? But once we understand it's a political tension that is caused by the US there, and the Sunnis and Shia who are fighting against other Sunnis and Shia will never reconcile politically without a US withdrawal. This changes the picture completely, right? When we understand that, for example, the refugee disaster, Noah will speak more about it, that the refugee disaster is not a disaster that is happening in a vacuum. It's not like Iraq was this island and it sunk in the ocean, and now we have these 4 million Iraqis that we should bring to the US or something, right? Iraqi refugees are in Jordan and Syria and other places because of what's happening in Iraq, and they want to go back home. And without understanding the political dynamics that is keeping them outside from their home, we'll be going in empty circles, right? We'll be thinking about how to deal with them in this vacuum without thinking that they are linked to the conflict in Iraq. So strategically, there is no way to deal with refugees and IDPs on the long run other than facilitating the conditions for them to go back home. This is what the majority of Iraqi refugees and IDPs want. Now, does this mean that there are no other things to do in the meanwhile, while we have the big fight to end all of the US presence there? Of course not. There are so many things to be done to ease the suffering of the millions of Iraqi refugees and IDPs, especially the ones who need help. There are so many ways to do that. As Noah was mentioning today, he was saying, during the sanctions, there are groups like Voices in the Wilderness that broke the law and put themselves in danger to collect money and send medicines to Iraqis. Now we don't have these sanctions. but we are not collecting money and we are not sending things to Iraqis. So that's why things that NOAA's organization, Electronic Iraq, is doing, the campaigns for short-term direct aid, are very important. There are many people who are dying because they don't have antibiotic, right? They are dying because they don't have food. They are dying because they don't have anyone to take care of them because of the destruction that happened to the civil society. So I think I will stop here. I will give time to NOAA to speak about more details. If you wanted to change the details about the refugees and how to what's the size of the disaster and how to deal with it on the short term and long term. And then after that, maybe I can discuss more details of how the situation in Iraq is in like the bigger picture and what are the potentialities for a comprehensive political solution that will end the war in Iraq. How there are the majority of Iraqi nationalist groups, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or Kurds, have announced peace plans proposing a safe passage of the U.S. outside their country. These are the same groups that are attacking the U.S. The thing that, like, I'll finish by saying is that the Iraq war is different than global warming, because in global warming, we can't negotiate with the sun and CO2, right? But in the Iraqi case, people who are attacking the U.S. troops have faces and headquarters and websites. And they are having peace plans now. They proposed peace plans, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or secular nationalists, for ending the violence and starting the process of reconciliation. But we never hear these things, not because the administration doesn't know about them. No, the opposite, because the administration doesn't want to recognize them. Because choosing Iraqi nationalists or the majority of Iraqis as an Iraqi partner will push the administration to cancel the plans for leaving permanent bases, cancel the plans for long-term control over oil. So what's happening in Iraq is not happening because of a lack of a peace partner. It's happening because of choosing to ignore the peace partner that is waiting there. Thank you.
Sharing agreement. From what little I know about it, I think who in their right mind would sign up for such an uneven distribution of oil? Is that a possibility that has momentum that the Iraqis will actually sign on to? The second question is, I don't understand how, when you were talking about one of the gentlemen whose father was kidnapped and was killed, you have the impression from the American side that there are a whole bunch of Iraqis that are these, you know, mindless heathens running around killing, we don't understand, decapitation, that kind of thing. What drives the different Iraqis to do that kind of thing to their fellow countrymen? And then third, what keeps the Iraqis in general from not hating us? I was talking to a Vietnamese the other day, and I was talking about what we did in Vietnam, and I said, why? She said, we forgive. When you think about what we've done, it's really despicable. So in light of all that's happening, what is the soul of the average Iraqi that has the capacity to say, you know, we forgive?
Let me start by the third question. I don't really know. Like, it's one of the things that I really admire, not just in Iraqis, in people around the region, that people like myself, I'm half Palestinian and half Iraqi. I've been, not just me, my parents and my grandparents have been destroyed, you know, like it's generations because of the U.S. intervention in the region. and other Lebanese and Syrians and Egyptians, and so many people have their life destroyed and lost loved ones because of the U.S. intervention, because of the U.S. elected government's intervention in the region, because of the U.S. taxpayers' money intervention in the region. But people still manage not to hate Americans. They still manage to separate between the U.S. foreign policy and between the U.S. as a country. So it makes me feel even like more shocked when I get discriminated against in the U.S. because I'm an Arab or a Muslim. Because I didn't vote for Al-Qaeda. I didn't pay taxes for Al-Qaeda. I didn't vote for Al-Qaeda a second time. But I still get discriminated against in airports and treated like a terrorist because of my accent or color or whatever, right? So, I mean, it is something that I seriously like can't understand how people can be that patient, and people in general don't hate Americans, and they understand that, you know, the U.S. public actually don't know what their U.S. foreign policy have been doing in the region. This I'm going back reverse with your questions. The second question's answer is that people who are carrying responsible for criminal acts in Iraq, like kidnapping or destruction, are different. There are different categories. There are a number of good websites that you can read to see what are these categories. One of the websites that I recommend as a good breakdown is Iraq Body Count. Iraq Body Count documents the Iraqi casualties, just those who were reported in Western media. So it doesn't really reflect how many people were killed in the streets, right? Latest studies indicate that maybe around 1 million Iraqis died because of the U.S. intervention in the last 4 years alone, not counting the sanctions people, right? But the Iraq Body Count numbers are around less than 100,000 till now. They are just for the documented cases. Now, the good thing about Iraq Body Count is that they put the reason for death, and they have a breakdown for the reason of death. So I think the last time I saw the latest update, it was around one quarter of reason of death was for directly by U.S. troops. They were killed directly by U.S. troops. And there was another, I think, quarter or one third by gangs, just criminal gangs, you know, the same gangs that will attack someone in the U.S., right? The same gangs that will appear in any country that the rule of law collapses. And there is a big chunk of them. The rest are unknown factors, you know. There is a very small it's like there's a mixture between Iraqi groups that attack civilians and unknown factors, right? So the unknown factors is this big category that many people don't know what it means. I think it means both Iraqi separatists who have a political agenda of attacking other Iraqis and ethnically cleansing neighborhoods for political reasons. I said when the Iraqi separatists came to Iraq in 2003, one of the major obstacles that faced them were the 2 million Sunnis in Shiastan and the 2 million Shia in Sunnistan, so, and the half a million Arab in Kurdistan. So that's why ethnic and sectarian cleansing started 2 days after the fall of Baghdad. I went to a southern city. It was what was it? It was Diwaniya, and there were some hundreds of Arab families that were kicked out of Kirkuk because they were Arabs, right? But why? Because of the separatist agenda, right? The same thing with many other Sunnis and Shia who were killed because of the separatist agenda. In addition to the documented secret plans that the U.S. and Britain had for attacking Iraqi civilians and initiating more sectarian violence. Let me give you two examples. Two royal forces, British royal forces, were caught red-handed, wearing like Arabs, you know, Arab clothes with covers on their heads, in a car with the guns and the explosives. And they were planting explosives to create more Iraqi-Iraqi tension, to create sectarian tension between Iraqi Sunnis and Shia in Basra. they were caught red-handed, filmed, interrogated, and put in a prison in Basra. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory, right? These are documented information that you can find on The Guardian, on like, their pictures are online, in fact, you can see them. The British army attacked the prison, broke into the prison, and freed both of them. And after that, there was one interrogator in the British army who wanted to investigate why were these two special forces doing this. And he was found dead. He committed suicide. I say they suicided him. I forgot his name now, but his story was covered in The Guardian. So that was a smoking gun that the British and American investment in these sectarian divisions in Iraq doesn't stop clean. You know, it's not just about putting some propaganda and planting some stories in Iraqi media. It actually goes one step, forward, and it actually is involved in creating violent acts among Iraqis and faking them. You know, the same thing with the Ahmed Chalabi's militias. You know Ahmed Chalabi's who? Ahmed Chalabi went back to Iraq with 650 mercenaries who were trained in Hungary by the American forces, American money. And I met them personally. I was in Baghdad, and they took over these two clubs in the middle of Baghdad, Nadi al-Sayed and Nadi al-Mansur, the club, the Hunting Club and Al-Mansur Club. One of them for their political wing, and the other for their military wing, called FIF at that time, Free Iraqi Fighters. They came with their Humvees, with when I met with a journalist to meet them, and they were with U.S. outfits, with Humvees, with U.S. guns, with everything, right? And then they disappeared overnight, all of the 650 mercenaries who were funded and supported by CIA. They disappeared. Ahmed Chalabi is still in Iraq, but no one knows where the 650 mercenaries went, right? There are documented information about their involvement in many of the sectarian acts. In fact, I saw a couple of videos they are documented, but they are not very... maybe they are not authentic, for some of his militias confessing on cameras that they did things when they were caught by other militias. Maybe it was faked, maybe not. But there is a big question about this involvement. The first question that I think is a very important question, the oil and gas law. The U.S. Congress put one of the benchmarks, benchmark number three, benchmark number three, which relates to... there are 18 benchmarks that the Bush administration and the Congress are imposing on the Iraqi government to... it's a good way to blame the Iraqis for failure. So within this blame the Iraqis, I call it, blame the Iraqis plan, there is one of the 18 benchmarks is passing a law that will require or guarantee that Iraqis will share their revenue in an equal way, because they think this is a good, or this is what they say, it's a good step for Iraqi reconciliation. As if they are, brokers of Iraqi reconciliation, you know? So the Bush administration has been pushing this other law that has nothing to do with revenue sharing. It's called the oil and gas law. It's pushing it with all of its power in Iraq. And this other law is called the oil and gas law. It has everything to do with privatizing Iraq's oil through production sharing agreements, as you mentioned. They're not used in the region. They're not used around the world. Less than 5% of the world production is based on production sharing agreements, PSAs, and just in cases where either there are no documented reserves of oil, or the price of oil to get oil out of the ground is expensive, very high that governments can deal with it. In the case of Iraq, Iraq is the second or third biggest oil reserve on earth, and getting Iraqi oil costs 50 cents a barrel compared to $50 a barrel sometimes in the Caspian Sea, you know? So PSAs are not needed in Iraq, but they are needed for the multinational oil companies because they give them huge profits. Hundreds of billions of dollars will go to multinational oil companies instead of just signing TSAs, the technical service agreements, that will give multinational oil companies flat rates to implement or, you know, work on you know, just a small job for a small time. So PSAs are number one of the problems with this oil and gas slump. The other main problem that is, it's the main problem behind the Iraqi parliament's resistance to this law, is that the law threatens Iraq's unity because it decentralizes the contracting. Instead of all contracts being signed by the central government of Baghdad, contracts will start being signed by Basra or Ramadi or the Kurdistan alone, opening doors for splitting Iraq into three regions. So it's a separatist law. Now, this law is not passing because of these reasons, right? At the same time, there is this other law sitting on someone's desk in Baghdad called the Revenue Sharing Law, which, surprise, it deals with revenue sharing. No one is pushing that law. Iraqis are not resisting it. It's very plain, like, straightforward. It's about getting all of the money, whether it was from oil or taxation or exports or anything, into this one bank account. Then it gets distributed to all of the Iraqi 18 provinces based on, like, a per capita distribution, you know? Iraqis are fine with it. And no one, why aren't they pushing it? Because if they pushed it and it will pass in 2 days or a week, then everyone will expose that this other law that has been being pushed doesn't have anything to do with revenue sharing, right? So, I mean, there is this deliberate mixture between the two issues, the oil and gas law, that is one of the major reasons why the Bush administration went to war in the first place, and the revenue sharing law that they are hiding behind to pass this oil and gas law. It's one of the dynamics, in fact, that plays within the Iraqi government. You can see how the Iraqi Council of Ministers passed the oil and gas law in one day because, you know, the U.S. told them pass it, they passed it. While the Iraqi parliament has been resisting it for 9 months now. So, I mean, it just shows how different dynamics inside the Iraqi government. The Iraqi parliament that was elected is against the law, but no one listens to it. The Iraqi cabinet that was selected by the U.S., passed the law, and of course, you know, it's always portrayed as the, you know, good part of the government because it's the U.S. employees there.
Well, at the end of the day, does the Iraqi, the separatist parliament, all of them, do they tremble before American policy and think, whatever we do, we don't want to upset America?
Separatists, for sure, because the separatists, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or secular, have been working with the U.S. administration for long years, since 2000, even before the war. In fact, the five separatist parties that are controlling the Council of Ministers, the two Shia parties, two Kurdish parties, and one Sunni separatist parties, have been in a united alliance in 2002, for example, in the London conference that prepared for the Iraq war. They were allied there. But the Bush administration usually misses this fact that these are the same five people that they've been working with from the beginning. And then every like year and a half, they say, hey, we have a national unity government. Look, there are Sunnis and Shia and Kurds and seculars working together. So we achieved a very good step in reconciliation. And then based on the collective amnesia for the U.S. public and media, after a year and a half, they say, we have a national unity government. And everyone goes like, whoa, national government. So like, they're the same parties that have been going. Those five parties don't say no to the Bush administration. But the other parties who actually represent the majority of Iraqis and are controlling the majority of the Iraqi parliament say no to the U.S. And that's why they've been killed, arrested, destroyed, demonized in the U.S. media for the last years because they say no, they dare to say no to the Bush administration's plans in Iraq.